Welcome to the session called Explore Spark 2.0 and Structured Streaming in Microsoft Azure HD Insight. I'm Maxim Lukyanov, Program Manager on Big Data team in Azure, and I work primarily on R Server and Spark in as part of Azure HD Insight service. So in this session, we'll have fairly straightforward structure. First, we'll talk about how we make available Spark in the cloud. Specifically, we'll talk about Azure HD Insight service. And then we'll dive straight into new features that come into Spark 2.0. And we'll cover its all primary components. We'll talk about data sets, structured streams, and we'll also dive a little bit into structured streams internals to discuss how new structured streams kind of deliver on its new promises. And finally, we'll have demo if Nishan fixed my machine. Okay, so let's start with Spark. So what is Spark? Spark in the recent times is basically a new hottest technology in big data space. If you are familiar with big data space, you probably know there is a Strata conference. It's one of the major conferences around. And I've been to Strata for a couple of years, this year and the last year. So if you were at Strata last year, you would realize that Spark was a big news. At that time, every session was talking about Spark, and Spark really captured the imagination, even at that kind of major event. If you were at Strata this year, you would see that Spark is no longer news, but you would still find it in every product offered at the conference, and every talk would incorporate Spark in its content. There is an expo floor at Strata as well, and many startups and companies present their products. So you'd find Spark in most of those booth stations as well. So Spark is becoming kind of a mainstream. It's now supported by all major vendors that offer Hadoop distributions, big companies like IBM and Microsoft making big bets on Spark. So Spark is moving into a mainstream. So that's great. It has a few things that are going for it, like a great momentum in the industry, large community of committers that contribute code to Spark, and as well, the community did a good job in making sure they release new releases of Spark on a fairly good cadence. About every 3 months in the past year, Spark released major new feature updates. And with slight delay, now we are talking about Spark 2.0, which brings new unified APIs, which brings speed improvements as part of the Tungsten 2.0, and new take on streaming technology called structured streams. So all those are all of the things that we are going to talk about today. So in Azure HD Insight, we offer Spark. So Azure HD Insight is an Azure cloud service that offers Spark as a managed service. So what do we mean by managed service? So first of all, we make it extremely easy for you to deploy clusters of machines that are configured to run Spark and related Hadoop components. So in a few clicks or with a simple script, you can create a cluster fully prepared for you to run Spark. We also make these bits that we deliver to you enterprise ready. So which means that we fully support them. And in order to accomplish that, we partnered with one of the major Hadoop distributors, Hortonworks, and we provide full supportability guarantees. So if there is any bug or problem, either in the open source code or in the Microsoft stack, Microsoft support engineers will help you resolve those. And if you need to push bug downstream into open source components, we'll do so with the help of Hortonworks. There is also high availability configuration and 24/7 support that are important components of any enterprise-ready cloud service. So those are provided for you as well, so you can expect that the cloud, that the cluster in the cloud that runs Spark will be always available, and there will be always somebody who will wake up at night to resolve any issues if they happen, so you don't need to. At this point, I'm happy to announce that later this week, we are also making, we are going to make available Spark 2.0 on Azure Engine Insight. At this point, Spark 2.0 is a still new release, so in the context of enterprise readiness, we need to kind of put the distinction between production-ready and production-ready workloads and not. So we are releasing Spark 2.0 with about 100 stability fixes to make sure that you can actually start applying it to a production environment. On top of enterprise-ready Spark in the cloud, we also provide a set of experiences as part of Azure Engine Insight service to make your data scientists and data engineers productive. And that implemented as part of the Azure notebooks, Jupyter notebooks in Azure, that this is a great environment for data exploration, as well as we provide plugins for integration with integrated development environments. And in case of Spark, we are talking about Scala programming language. So those plugins work with IntelliJ and Eclipse, two major kind of development platforms for Scala. And finally, we also provide ODBC drivers that you can use to connect to BI tools. So Spark, one of the use cases of Spark is data warehousing. So you can easily accommodate that and bring your connect your Power BI or Tableau or any other BI tool to Spark and use it as a data warehouse. And finally, last kind of piece of set of features that we offer on top of Azure Insight service is integration with other Azure services as well. So one of the kind of major production workloads that we found our customers do is building data processing pipelines. And this we help automate with a service called Azure Data Factory. So you can build Azure Data Factories that build pipelines that incorporate Spark jobs. We also provide connector for Power BI and for streaming services. For Spark Streaming, we provide connectors for Azure service that works on events or streams called Event Hubs. And there is also real-time dashboard support in Power BI. So we provide connector for real-time dashboards in Power BI as well. Okay, so with that, we can jump into Spark 2.0. And before we get started, let me clarify a couple of things. How many of you are familiar with Spark? Okay. More than a half. So we can safely dive into a great kind of depths of Spark 2.0. And another question, are you a developer or IT pro? So who is a developer here? Also more than a half. And are you IT pro? About 20%. Okay, thank you. So what's new in Spark 2.0? The first is new APIs that allow you to seamlessly create your data pipelines. And now, as you'll see in a minute, this can be both batch-oriented pipelines as well as streaming pipelines. Second is a major improvement to the core engine of Spark that moves it towards abilities of generating code and makes it more like a compiler. We'll talk about it in depth. The major feature or major benefit of that feature is a great speed improvement that it gives. And finally, a new version of streaming architecture that comes in Spark 2.0 called Structured Streams. There are also other smaller features in Spark 2.0 like extended support for SQL standard, new machine learning algorithms that are available in R language. But we will, in this session, we'll focus on core improvements to Spark 2.0 that take it to a next level in terms of its architecture. So let's start with data sets. So in order to kind of talk about data sets, we need to start with the core of the Spark, with its resilient distributed data sets, and understand what was limiting in that technology. Success of Spark so far was driven forward in large part because the level of abstraction and implementation of the RDDs was so great. So what is lacking in them? So what is RDD? The RDD is an object, core object in Spark that represents three pieces of information. First, it has a notion of partition, and that allows it to distribute data set across multiple machines. That includes notion of data locality, which allows Spark to run computation on the same machine where data resides. Second is a notion of lineage. Each RDD has a notion of an input of data, which is another RDD. And it, at any time, it can ask, recompute its state by asking this parent RDD to give this input data again. That forms a core of the computational graph that Spark basically executes. And finally, the most important piece of the RDD is a computation that it encapsulates. And in RDD, this abstraction is very generic. It says, hey, it can be any Java function that returns, that processes input data and outputs the output data. And that is a very generic abstraction that ties Spark to Java. Basically, this contract says that you can operate on any data structure that Java supports, and you can execute any operation that Java supports. Basically, that implies that while you're executing these computations, you would have to rely on the Java runtime to perform data manipulations and actually execute arbitrary Java code. So these computations and data structures are invisible to the Spark as a data processing engine. They're opaque to Spark. And that's a major limitation of the abstraction that is too generic, that prevents Spark from taking from making more optimizations to the computations that it performs on data. And that's the problem that data sets and data frames are solving in the new Spark 2.0. So what is data set? Data set accomplishes three things. First, it brings the knowledge of the data structures. And that implies that it brings also limitations on what kind of data structures you can have. So the data structures that data sets and data frames operate on are transparent to Spark. And second, it brings structure and transparency to computations as well. So at this point, if you were familiar with Spark 1.6, you can say, hey, but this is the data frames from 1.6. The transparent computation and data were available as part of the data frames already. And you would be right. And in that sense, data set is the same thing as a data frame. But it brings one third additional feature, which is type safety. And this is where it moves the kind of equation forward. Dataset also allows you, in addition to transparent computation and data, it allows you to express your computations in operations in a type-safe manner. And you can see here an example of this type-safe computations. You can basically use Spark to read some arbitrary JSON file, rely on its ability to infer the schema of this data, and then tell Spark to treat this content of data as a class person. That's a Scala language if you're not familiar with that. And then you can express computations over this data using type-safe operations. So you can, in this example, we'll do group by, and we'll do some histogram computation on this person object. The benefit of that approach of type safety is that you get compile time errors. And this slide summarizes what type of structured computations you can now perform in Spark 2.0. You can do just a SQL query language that's still supported. You can use data frame APIs, and you can use new dataset APIs. And the differences between them are well described by the moment when you get an error. If you write a SQL, it will be just a script, and all of the errors will be at runtime when you actually try to run the script. If you write your computation, if you express your computations in the form of data frames, then you get compile time errors if you perform incorrect operations. But if you misspelled the field name, then you'll get this error only at runtime. And finally, with data sets, you'll get all of the errors, even if you just misspelled the field name or table name at compile time. And that increases your productivity and also enables one important factor. It enables powerful code manipulation techniques like refactoring. So now you can safely apply refactoring to your code and know that all of the field names will not escape code refactoring tools. In Spark 2.0, this data frame and data set APIs are brought together. And data frame basically is just an alias that says, oh, I am just a data set that operates on an untyped row, class row. These two data frame APIs and data set APIs are connected with each other. So you can treat the data set of typed objects as a data frame and operate and apply all of the operations available in data frame to data sets. And vice versa, you, at any moment in time, for any data frame, you can say, hey, I want to treat it as a data set, and I want to enforce some specific schema of a specific class on this data frame. And that is accomplished by as operator. So you can specify how you want to treat data in this class. All of these endpoints, the SQL, data frame, and data set, now have structure. And Spark can now take them and apply all of the optimizations to the structured computation and data. And this is available through Catalyst as a query optimization component in Spark. And all three share the same optimization engine. So as the first step of this query optimization, all three types of queries will be transformed into a single representation of logical query plan. Then it will be optimized by applying operations such as predicate pushdown into optimized logical plan. And as a next step of optimization, there will be physical optimization applied, which will apply operations such as choosing what type of join to apply to the data sets based on their size and things like that. And finally, in the end, you'll get a good old graph of RDDs that actually represent a physical computational plan for Spark. Here is an example of a logical query plan that is generated for this query expressed in a data frame. The interesting part here is this filter that is expressed using data frame expressions. You can see that we are trying to filter this data set on the age field, and there is some predicate on that. So in a logical plan, you can see that Spark was able to understand that computation and express it in a logical plan, not as some arbitrary function, but it actually able to say that, hey, I see that there is a predicate on an age field. And that is important because now Spark can arbitrarily optimize this computation and express it in a way that is most optimal for a given situation. For example, if you were to use just an RDD APIs in the past, then this predicate on a field would look like an anonymous function to Spark. And it wouldn't be able to convert it into anything else. These expressions that we just used, Spark is able to understand the meaning, the semantics of that computation, and as you can see in the next steps, would implement it differently depending on the context. There are many expressions that Catalyst support to allow us as the developers to specify a variety of predicates in a way that is transparent to the Spark as a data engine. So you can use string manipulation functions, mathematical functions, and the rest of the functions in your data frame and data set API calls. So one of the optimizations that now Spark is able to perform based on this transparent structured computations is predicate pushdown. And in this example, we are talking about scenario where you are using Spark as a federated query engine on top of some external data source. For example, SQL Server. So if you express this query, you would ask Spark to connect to a SQL Server and retrieve some data and apply this predicate on edge. So now that the predicate is transparent, Spark will actually, as part of its query optimization process, will push down this predicate down into a SQL Server. And for this federated scenario, if you're familiar with SQL Server, that may have a dramatic impact on performance. And that's what these new techniques kind of enable for Spark. They enable new scenarios where Spark can start operating more intelligently on external data and perform much more make much more optimized decisions. Yeah, go ahead. That's a great question. The question is, how far this predicate pushdown goes? Like, what are the capabilities of predicate pushdown? Right now, in theory, these capabilities can be pretty extensive. But right now, they're limited by the contract that is set on the data source APIs in Spark. And right now, they work only on the conjunction of simple predicates. So it will push down any ends and actual predicates, but it will not be able to push down any or any more complex expressions like that. Okay. You talked about transparent and structured computations. The next part of that is structured data model. So in a Spark 2.0, we have a final realization of Tungsten project, where all of this work come to fruition. And Spark now takes over the memory management from Java VM and manages all of the data that it processes by itself, by using just a flat memory arrays that it allocates from outside of the Java heap. And at the 2.0 version, it supports quite a rich data structures. It supports all of the primitive types. It allows you to have arrays as a column type, as well as structs and dictionaries. So if your data structure is more complex than that, Spark would have to fall back into a regular kind of Java object allocation. But if your data structures fit within these boundaries, then all of the optimizations that we're talking about would apply. For example, so what does it look like? So it has it makes a significant difference of how you handle objects. For example, if you allocate Java string, then it's well known that there is a 48 bytes overhead that you'd pay for each string that you allocate. And with the new direct memory operation, Spark kind of eliminates that overhead, as well as many other benefits that it provides. This example shows kind of binary row encoding used in Spark. So if you have a row that consists of these three values, one is integer and a couple of strings, in the data structures that Spark allocate, it will allocate this binary object that looks like that. So you can see that it uses direct memory offsets to specify where string resides, and it uses direct in-memory placement for integers. So there is no overhead involved in terms of allocating separate object for every column. All of the data is placed as a single in a single byte array. In 2.0, so what you saw just now is the row-based representation of data. In 2.0, Spark also introduces a columnar binary representation of data, where instead of grouping data by a row, it actually groups data by a column. And that improves cache locality and efficiency of aggregation operations significantly due to CPU architecture and how cache in CPU works. One of the benefits of that direct memory allocation is just the space efficiency. So with data sets and direct memory representation, you just get remove all of the Java overhead, and you're talking about significantly less amount of memory that is needed to represent your data set in memory. And another benefit that is very important is reduction in terms of data serialization, deserialization. In fact, now that Spark operates with these binary data structures, if it needs to send this data set to some other machine for shuffling, it actually doesn't need to perform any data serialization. It can just send these bytes over the network and start operating over this data on another machine directly. So that leads to a dramatic improvement in terms of serialization, deserialization performance. The next phase of optimization is actually putting together these two aspects, transparent computation and transparent data. So once you have information about those two, you can do the ultimate optimization where you can say, hey, I can just generate the code that is exactly doing what computation asks to do and operates on a data structures that are optimized to what is asked to do. So you can basically transform your data framework into a compiler that generates as efficient code as possible. And you might hear about Spark 2.0 phrases like, hey, Spark 2.0 brings computation to a bare metal. So that's what it means. Spark now is able to generate code that tries to squeeze out as much as possible from your hardware at the lowest level available. For example, if you're talking about a simple query that counts a number of rows with applying of some filter, as a result of this code generation, Spark will generate code that doesn't have any virtual function invocations. It has just a simple loop that you would write in C, and it accesses data directly using local variables. So that would be the most efficient that it can be from the programming point of view. For example, kind of more detailed example here, if you recall our predicate with age, then as a catalyst expression, it would be expressed as a transparent object for Spark. And at the code generation moment, Spark will actually use direct memory access to read the value from the particular offset in memory, then apply a specified predicate in place and return results back. Additional benefit comes here from the Java platform support for this so-called unsafe memory operations, where you can express this operation of retrieving a value from a particular offset, and Java will at JIT time will actually translate this operation into direct memory offset operations. So this translates into a significant speed up for the queries that involve lots of computations and lots of memory operations. So now with Spark 2.0, you'll rarely see garbage collection overhead or problems with garbage collection. And in terms of TPCDS results, we can see speed up from 3x to 10x. So that's very good. So any questions so far? Okay. So let's talk about structured streams. So existing Spark streaming APIs existed for quite some time. And they're quite good in terms of throughput. They allow you to build a pipeline that produces exactly one semantics of event processing, but there is no way to guarantee that your streaming pipeline does it. You can build a fault-tolerant pipeline as well. but there's also a set of limitations. And first, the significant limitation is that there is no notion of the event time in Spark in current in DStreams APIs, and that makes it nearly impossible to express very common operation where you want to ensure that the event that arrived late will actually be processed with the other events that belong to it based on its event time. There is a lack of interoperability between your streaming pipelines and the batch operations in Spark. Basically, it's very hard to query results of the streaming pipeline and bring it inside of some web application. And while exactly one semantic processing is possible, it's actually your responsibility as a developer in DStreams APIs to make sure that you use correct components and you configure the system correctly so that you never lose events and you always calculate, produce correct results. And finally, kind of fault tolerance and high availability in DStreams are based on the checkpointing mechanism. And in some cases, it's actually very inefficient as it doesn't have ability to do the checkpoint with a partial state update. It always needs to kind of save the full result of your streaming processing. So all of those limitations targeted to be fixed in a new structured streaming. And structured streaming is a complete rewrite, basically, of the streaming from the past. It's a completely new implementation of streaming engine. It is nicely integrated with data frames. So now we are talking about a single API that you can use to run your batch queries as well as streaming queries. So there is no difference. You just treat the data set that you're operating on as an ever-increasing infinite data set if you're operating over the streaming data. But from that point of view, there is no difference from the actual queries that you're writing, whether you're writing batch or streaming. At the high level, structured streaming offers new APIs that kind of take much more responsibility for you than it was in the past. So now structured streaming provides much more guarantees. It always provides guarantee of exactly one's processing semantic of event processing. So that means that regardless of how you write your streaming pipeline now, you will always get this guarantee, which is basically an almost always the case that you would want to have those semantics. And finally, there is many improvements in terms of how you actually operate with your streaming pipelines. You can integrate it with batch mode. You can manage queries in a much more convenient manner than before. There is an integration with ML models that is coming as well. So let's take a look at how new streaming APIs look like. First, we'll start with a batch query. And in this query, we would read some JSON file, apply the query, and produce the results, and save results in some place. With new streaming APIs, it's very easy now to convert this query into a streaming query. You just change the input and output, and the query itself actually remains the same because the APIs are the same. So you change the read statement to read stream statement, and you define what is the source of your streaming. And when you're writing, you're specifying what is the output of your writing, but the query remains the same. In terms of logical model of streaming execution, new streaming still remains kind of a microbatch model. So it still retains this microbatch architecture. And the first, the input data is now treated as an ever-increasing append-only table. And Spark Streaming detects moments, triggers, when the new data has arrived. So once the new data arrived, it starts a new query processing. So it takes this, it generates this microbatch and sends it to process the query. And after the query produces the results, it sends it to the output. There are three modes of output. The simplest one is a complete output, where all of the results of the query processing will be sent to the output every time the microbatch is processed. But you also can do append-only mode, where only new rows that were generated during query processing will be sent to output, and the delta mode, where only changes will be sent out. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, the question is, what would be the example where this can be used in business? Well, during demo, we'll have a couple of examples. I think that would help. But to briefly answer your question, it actually depends on the query, what kind of output you would want. So some queries actually wouldn't make sense without complete output. For example, if you're counting all of the rows in the stream, the output will always be a complete output with just a single number. But for some queries that process kind of deltas of the data, you'd use append only or delta mode. But in the demo, we'll get to it in more detail. So here's an example of the ever increasing count, or actually average in this case. So you can say that on a stream, I want to count average of a query time. And for the times that the query is run, it will always calculate this average. And the output of this query, regardless of how large your input is, will always be a single number, the average at this point in time. You can also express a group by query, where you can group by a specific column and do averages within each group. And you can also now, a new feature in Spark 2.0, you can apply a window function to your groups and calculate averages or any other aggregates for each window in this group. Nice part about this new window function is that it's also available for batch queries as well. So you can rerun your query over the static data and produce the same result. Now that we have unified APIs between batch and streaming processing, the more advanced operations like joins become possible. So in this example, you can see how you can implement a very common operation in streaming, where you have a reference data set, and as part of your streaming process, you need to look up some data from this reference data set. So now you can express this operation as a join and join static data set into your streaming pipeline. And every time the microbatch is executed, you would get the joint results to produce some output. And fine, yeah. The question is there a different type of windows? So that's a great question. So if you go back here, so this is a hopping window. So it basically represents a slice of time where the values will be calculated. Spark also supports a sliding window, where you can have a second parameter which would overlap where with two windows would overlap. You can also call it tumbling window, depending on how you call it. Okay, so in terms of query processing, in the past, when you deal with streaming pipelines, you had to create streaming contexts, and they were very hard to manage. So for every streaming process, you had to have your separate streaming context. Now Spark kind of gains a knowledge about all the streaming pipelines that you have within the single Spark context. So you can create as many queries, streaming queries as you like, and they all will be visible as part of your Spark context. And then when you actually create the start streaming process, you get an object, query object, that you can use to manage those queries. You can stop them, check their status, see what exception they generated, and things like that. Any questions so far? Is there any way to limit the queries to only to data that you haven't seen before? Yeah, so that's we'll actually get into this in this section. But that's exactly the new promise that structured streaming gives you. It actually gives you exactly once processing semantics. So you always get this guarantee. And we'll see how this is actually implemented. Okay, so a little bit about how all of these promises are guaranteed by Spark. So first of all, given that APIs, again, are unified, regardless of whether you specify a streaming pipeline or streaming query or batch query, you always get a data frame. But they will be of different types. And only at the moment when you actually execute this data frame, Spark Catalyst Optimizer will generate different execution plans. And in case of streaming query, it will generate what's called incremental execution plan. So it will create an object called planner that will be always resident in memory and it will manage lifetime of your query. So it will generate incremental physical plans every time it will detect that the new data is available. And then it will go through the Spark processing pipeline to execute this new incremental physical plan. The planner, that's an object that is now central to the streaming query, will periodically poll the sources of your data and check for the availability of the new data. And then it will schedule the new incremental execution plan and will generate, that one will generate the output. In this example, let's say we have a very simple query that counts rows. So in the first time, planner will detect that there is offsets of data available from 90 to 100. It will schedule an execution, and the result of that execution will be a count of 100, assuming that there were 100 rows. The next time the planner checks the source of the data, it may detect that the new set of data is available from the offsets of 100 to 110. And it will then generate new execution plan, and the execution plan will generate a new count that, hey, now it's 110 items counted. So what's important here is that during these aggregations, the incremental execution one needs to pass information about its current count to the incremental execution two. So there is a notion of the state that you need to preserve during these streaming calculations. And Spark now has a first-class new object called state store that stores the state. So once the incremental execution one finishes its calculation, it will store the current count, which is 100 at this point, into the state store. And the next time planner schedules execution two will read the state store, will read the value of 100, and will continue with its calculations. And after it finishes the calculations, it will update the current state store. Yes, question. The question is, what happens when the fault happens? And you're talking about exactly about the next slide that we are going to. Perfect. So what happens during faults? So that is the most important question in the streaming processing. How you recover faults and how you keep yourself efficient and fast in while doing so. So in order to achieve fault tolerance and preserve exactly once processing semantic guarantees that Spark structured streaming now has, you have to ensure that recovery of all of the components that you have in your system kind of falls first is possible, and second guarantees this exactly once processing semantics. So how is this accomplished? So let's review component by component. So first, planner, that is the central system for any streaming query, maintains its state in a write-ahead log. So every time planner makes a decisions about scheduling new incremental execution, it writes these decisions into a write-ahead log. And if planner fails at any moment in time, it aborts or marks all of the in-flight executions as failed, and it will go back to the last one that it knows successfully succeeded, and will schedule retry of all of the operations after that. And that retry of all operations after that has implications for the rest of the components in the system. First, it has implication on the sources. So if at any moment in time, planner can say that, hey, stop this particular execution, I deem it incorrect, you need to be able to restart this execution. And that means that you need to be able to read this, the same data set from the source. So the sources are now have a guarantee on them, or have to provide a guarantee that they are replayable. And those, and this is a kind of a simple requirement for modern sources in the streaming pipelines, like both Kafka and Event Hub provide this guarantee as part of their core design. Sorry. But that's kind of a first requirement on the sources that feed into this guarantees that structured streaming provides. The second is a state store. So that's a critical component of new system. So whenever you need to restart execution, you may find yourself in a situation where some of the state updates have already happened, and now you need to roll them back. So that basically transforms your state store in a transactional NoSQL database, no less than that. So at the moment of a failure, planner would actually need to instruct state store to reconstruct its state to some point in to some point back in time and reject all of the updates that were not complete. That's a very strong guarantee, and that's actually jumping a little bit ahead is the reason why structured streaming in its current implementation in Spark 2.0 is marked as an alpha release. Because the current implementation for state store is actually fairly simplistic, and it has some difficulties with scaling, and that's the primary reason that leads to kind of an alpha state of the structured streaming feature as a whole. So the next component is syncs. And in case of failure, what you can encounter is that you would need to send the output of your computation again to your sync, to the output of your data. And the only way to actually make sure that this doesn't lead to a corruption of data or to incorrect calculation is to require the sync of your data to be idempotent, which means that it should be possible to write the same results into your output without double counting or without producing incorrect results. So that's a set of guarantees that kind of drive end-to-end exactly once processing semantics. Basically, in structured streaming, Spark achieves that by making these requirements on the components of the system and by implementing, by carefully implementing fault recovery in its own core engine. Okay, so let's see if our demo works still. Any questions so far? Okay. Now give me a second. That should be 7. Okay, let's see. Oh, sorry. Okay, so let me switch back. You'll need to recover the demo. The doesn't look like keyboard is working on my machine. Let's give it a minute to try, and we'll see how it goes. Okay, now it's working. Okay, so let's switch back now here. Yeah, keyboard is working, so we should be good. Let's increase font size so you can see it. Okay, yeah, that's great. So on this cluster, I have Spark installed. So let's launch Spark shell. So you can see it. Okay, that's great. And let's open second window as well, because we'll need to simulate some streaming operations. So let's make sure we have two windows to do that. Didn't work. Let's increase font size of this one as well. Okay, let's resize it. Okay, perfect. So on the right window, we'll create a simple socket server that will just output on its HTTP socket the characters that we'll type on the keyboard. So that's the right window. And on the left window, we have Spark 2.0 shell. And let's use some scripts that I prepared to run. So first of all, we will create some streaming queries. And in this example, we'll use the as a source of our data, we'll use this HTTP server again. So the first one would be, hey, how do we specify the streaming operation? So Spark structured streaming today comes with a few built-in sources. So one of the built-in sources is a socket, is a format socket, has a format socket. So that allows you to connect to arbitrary HTTP socket and start reading this data and treat it as a stream of events. So let's create that one, and we'll call it lines. As you can see, when we created it, it produced the data frame, but nothing else happened. So that's kind of a natural property of the data frames that now applies to streaming operations. So when you specify your query, you're just building this data frame object, but no calculations happening at this time. So you need to start the query in order to actually start processing. So let's continue building our query. So we get our input characters, and now we'll do some word count. So we'll convert our data frame into a data set by treating each row as just a string, and then we'll apply our custom code using flatmap operation to split the string into words using space as a delimiter. So let's do that. And again, we'll get a new data frame or data set now that still doesn't produce any computations. So further, we'll apply a group by operation. And we are building a streaming pipeline. But you can see here, we are using just a regular data frame APIs to do that. So we'll group by each word, and we'll calculate the count of those words. Again, we get new data frame. And finally, we can start the actual calculation by using a write stream operation and starting it. The important pieces here are output mode, which we will use complete, which means that every time the microbatch is executed, we'll see the complete results of the query processing. And again, there is a few built-in syncs in structured streaming. And the one that's very useful for debugging is a console sync, which will just print the full output of your streaming query to the console every time batch query is executed. So now let's start the query processing. And you can see that the result of this operation is a query object, streaming query. And now it's active. So let's try to type some characters. So let's say A, B, C, and a couple more repeats. So you can see that new batch was formed, and it's been processed, and the full output is printed to the console. So we detected that there is ABC in our input, and the A was repeated 3 times. So let's try it once more. And you can see that, again, new batch is generated, and it generates output. So let's do some query management. So this query is running in the background. So we can explore what we have in Spark. So I believe it's active. Nope. Okay. Oh, streams, yeah. So now the Spark context, which is now called in Spark 2.0 called Spark Session, has a streams collection that has collection of all of the streams that Spark context is managing. So we can say streams active, and then we can say for each and print them. So now we can see that in the active, there is an active stream that is called streaming query, query zero. So now we can see all of the queries that we have created inside of our Spark session. And one of the operations that we can do is to simply stop our query from executing. So now if we type more characters here, we wouldn't see any processing happening. So that's very convenient. The next step is a very nice feature in Spark structured streaming, which allows you to very easily run batch queries over the results of your streaming process. And that's accommodated through another built-in format, which is in-memory table. So you can convert those results of streaming process in just a table, in the Spark table, that you can later on use in your batch queries. So let's do that. So in this case, we will use our word counts, we'll sort them by value, and we'll output, again, complete result into in-memory table called counts. So let's do that. So now another streaming query is running in the background, and let's feed it some data, again, ABC, and let's use Ricky and ABC, and you'll see in a minute why I used Ricky. And now we can query this table, because now we have table counts. So let's see. Yep. So it has all of the values that our streaming calculation computed so far. This is a great example of how you can build a very powerful web applications or some representation logic that represents the current real-time state of your system. Like imagine dashboards that show current count of alerts, or dashboards that represent kind of latest processed events. All of that becomes very simple now with this in-memory tables that Spark provides. And the final example, let's do the join with the reference data set. So I have a very simple three-line JSON file. So let's show its content. So it has just an age and name column. And we'll use name column for a join. So we'll join it with our query processing. And the join will be expressed using data frame APIs. So we'll say, hey, word counts, which is our streaming query, join with the people, which is our static data set, using values and name as a join condition. And the join will be left outer, so we don't lose data in our streaming context if there is no corresponding key in the static data set. Then we'll do some shaping of the data, and we'll write it again into console so we can see the results. Okay, so now it's running. Query 2 was created. And if we put some more Rikis here and some more ABCs, we'll see that new batch is being processed, and the result of the output is for ABCs, there is no age column, but for Ricky that is present in our static data set, we successfully joined the age into our streaming computation. Okay, So we did that already. And another variant of actually joining the tables is joining with in-memory table. So not only as part of the streaming calculation, you can join data with a streaming data set, but our in-memory table that is still running in the background, you can join with it as well. And in another example here, you can see that you can use SQL to operate with data from your streaming queries. So it's all interoperable. You can use data frame, data set, or SQL syntax to work with your streaming or batch data in all combinations. So if you look back, you can see that our in-memory table accumulated two rekeys, and it successfully joined its edge from the static data set. Okay. So that concludes our demo. We can switch back to the session. So any questions so far? Okay. So in terms of roadmap, I already mentioned that structured streaming is currently in the alpha state. It has some missing features, like there is no even sync for Kafka or for Event Hub, for example. There is only sync for this built-in kind of HTTP server. So in addition to missing features, there is also some scalability improvements that needs to happen. So in the Spark 2.1, we expect to reach the point where we'll be able to actually use structured streaming pipelines in production. But regardless, structured streaming still represents a significant step forward to Spark from the architectural point of view. And once all of the components fall into place, it will make it extremely, much easier to build a reliable and robust streaming pipelines. Here's a documentation that captures kind of a first steps of structured streaming. You can use that one. And in terms of sessions, if you're interested in more information about Spark, tomorrow we have a session about doing interactive analysis with Spark using all the other features that I mentioned available to you as part of HD Insight, like notebooks, plugins for ID, all things like that. So we'll explore that part. We'll also talk tomorrow again how you can use R server on top of Spark. So if you're R person, R server gives great kind of features for you for scalable machine learning. And now, in the new version of R server, it's actually running on top of Spark. It uses Spark as its distributed compute engine. So we'll talk about that. And if you're interested in just overview of all of the big data services that we have in Azure, we had a session about that called, the ID of it is 3248. So you can look it up and watch the recording of that. And there is also additional resources for you available, and even more resources for you available. And please let us know how we can improve the session. Please submit your evaluations.